This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. It can be said that Malaysia is built on the backs of migrant labourers. We see them everywhere, cleaning our streets, fixing our rooftops, serving us at restaurants, banging and clanging in factories, and even taking care of our kids. However, new reports pop up every other week about foreign labourers overworked, underpaid, and placed in horrible living environments. Some call it forced labour, some might even say modern-day slavery. But what exactly constitutes forced labour, and how do a lot of big companies get away with it a lot of times without much public awareness at all? So joining me on the show today to share their insights are Leva Sridharan, a labour rights consultant, and Sumita Shantini Krishna from the NGO Our Journey. Sumita is also a lawyer who provides legal representation for migrants and refugees. Welcome to the show, ladies. How are y'all today?
Thank you for having us on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
All right, Sumita, perhaps we can start with you. Before we get into the meat of the discussion, maybe you can break down what exactly constitutes forced labour from an international human rights perspective.
Sure. So Malaysia is a signatory to the ILO Fundamental Convention on Forced Labour, that is a C29. And Malaysia ratified that convention in 1957. And the Forced Labour Protocol, which is the P29 that supplements this this forced labor convention, is yet to be ratified by the country. So if you look at the Convention on Forced Labor, it defines forced labor as all work or services which is exacted from any person under the manners of any penalty for which the said person has not offered himself voluntarily.
Right.
So this is what constitutes forced labor.
And what are the labor laws like in Malaysia, particularly when it comes to the rights of foreign workers? Are they in line with these standards?
I would say the labor laws are in line with the standard. There's nothing wrong with the labor laws, but our policies are not in line with the international labor standards. For example, our policy allows employers to hold the passport of the worker with consent. The Passport Act does not allow anyone to hold the passport of another, but the policy allows this. And also there's another policy that does not allow the worker to change employment without the consent of the employer. This is all constitutes forced labor.
I just like to chime in and to say that in terms of forced labor, right, I think there's also one thing that we need to bear in mind, that in Malaysia, unfortunately, there is actually no forced labor offense in Malaysian law.
Okay.
So what we have are actually elements of forced labor that can be prosecuted under various laws, such as the Employment Act and the Anti-Trafficking in Persons and Smuggling of Migrants Act. This is actually a really big gap because it makes the offense very, very hard to enforce from a law enforcement perspective and from a prosecution perspective. Now, what I mean by this is, you know, if I'm a judge, for example, how do I decide when something is or is not forced labor when it is not in the law? So, I mean, as civil society organizations, we are actually expecting some amendments to the ATIPSOM or the Anti-Trafficking in Persons Law and some of our labor laws. And we understand that the lack of a definition of forced labor might be addressed in these amendments. So hopefully when it is passed in Parliament, we will finally see a clear definition of forced labour in our laws, which will actually enhance law enforcement and increase the protection of victims of forced labour in Malaysia.
Now, Leva, why do foreigners love coming to Malaysia to look for jobs? Of course, on the one hand, we know that most, if not all of them, come or leave their country because of economic and political turbulence in their home country. But why Malaysia specifically? What are the stories they are being told at home about Malaysia? And what are they expecting when they get on the plane or on the ship and to come to Malaysia? What are they hoping to get here?
Right. So I think we need to bear in mind that Malaysia offers one of the highest minimum wage rates within the ASEAN region. So that itself makes Malaysia a fertile ground for employment. There's also the availability of jobs. And there's also a robust recruitment system in place in some of our neighboring countries. And Malaysia, being where it is located geographically, it is actually like very close to various country borders within the ASEAN region and even within South Asia. So it makes Malaysia very attractive to many of these workers. But I think we also need to bear in mind that many workers come to Malaysia out of necessity and not on a whim. I've got this case of one of these workers, and I asked him, why he's Pakistani, and I asked him, why did you decide to come to Malaysia? And he told me, he said, Liva, I've got two sons. So I didn't make sense of this. I'm like, okay, like many people have children, doesn't mean that they have to migrate. And he said, my sons are getting older and they're now becoming teenagers and we don't have enough food at home. So when I have roti with my elder son, my wife and my younger son cannot eat that night. And if my son and my wife eat their roti the night after, me and my elder son cannot have our roti. So we take turns to have our meals. So we need to be reminded that many migrants come out of necessity to Malaysia for employment and not on a whim.
So before they leave their country, coming to Malaysia seems like a very positive thing. But what is the reality when they actually arrive? What's the reality of the situation?
So based on my experience, right, many migrant workers from the source country are painted a very green picture, a very bright picture of what to expect in Malaysia. And while some of these expectations are met, admittedly so, we also find that many migrants who come to Malaysia realize that what was promised in the country of origin isn't what they received when they arrive in Malaysia. So an example of this would be, so a migrant, for example, is promised 1,500 ringgit Malaysia as monthly wages. But when they come to Malaysia, they end up receiving maybe 700 or 800 ringgit. So that's almost half of what was promised. Migrants sometimes are promised, 8 to 12 hours of working per day. So 8 hours being, they get their regular pay for 8 hours, and then anything beyond that is overtime payment. But when they arrive and they work for 12 hours, they realize that they don't get paid for this overtime work. And many migrants are also very surprised when they speak to me to find that the employers keep their passports or their documents. Some experience verbal, physical exploitation. Conditions are sometimes worse for women. So if you look at some of the work that I've done, in the plantation sectors, so women, for example, if they don't listen to their bosses or if they don't, perform what the bosses want them to perform. So, for example, if it's even things like sexual favors, so these women are then isolated and they are forced to work in very far away areas on plantations, and then there's risk of being robbed, being raped. And other kinds of harassment. So it can actually be worse for women who are employed in Malaysia.
I must add, if you ask a migrant 10 years ago, as what Liva says, they would say Malaysia was their choice of destination country because it's attractive in all the sense that Liva had mentioned. But in recent times, if you ask them, they would say that if they are not able to go to countries like Korea, Japan, Taiwan, or even the Middle East, then they will settle for Malaysia. Because Malaysia is also one of the countries that is you can get in comparatively easier than countries like, example, Singapore or Japan or Korea, right, because of their immigration checks are more stringent than ours. Even our social tourist visa are more relaxed than these countries. That's why we also see a lot of migrants coming in with a social visa.
But Sumita, how does this happen? And because Liva brought up that, like you said, a lot of the positives, right? But at the same time, the reality, like she mentioned, is that they can be promised 1,500, 1,300. But then the reality is they're getting 800 ringgit per month. That is almost half, less than what they're supposed to be making. So maybe we can take this step by step and, try and gain some perspective on what actually goes down. Because I've read a number of accounts where experts say the problem usually begins right at the recruitment stage when the people are still in their home countries. What can you tell us about that?
I think that is absolutely true. What we see is the minute the worker goes to approach an agent, example, the first thing that the agent will do is either take the worker's passport or help him to get a passport. And once they do that, and they take a deposit from the worker as well, a small deposit. It's not much, but they'll take a small deposit. Once they do that, the worker has no prospects of going to another agent. And he has to follow what this particular agent tells him. So say, suppose he says that, yes, you are going to get a work example in Korea, but then he'll come back and tell you, oh, sorry, we can't get you there because it's too expensive, but we can give you something in Malaysia at 1,005.
Right.
You know, and the migrant has no way of saying no because he has already invested. He doesn't have his passport even when he's in his own country. So he doesn't even see the employment contract even until he goes to the airport. He has already invested everything, paid everything, and then he sees that he is getting lesser than what he has been promised. He has no choice. He will take that and come to the country because he cannot remain in his country because he's already indebted with either selling his land or his house or taking a loan. So he has to come.
And
so that is exactly why they say that the problem starts from the country of origin.
And this idea of taking the passports, is that supposed to be an official part of the process, or is this something recruiters and agents do to sort of take advantage of these people who a lot of times they may be uneducated, they may be poor, they may not be well versed in what's going on, and so these agents and recruiters, they take advantage of the situation?
Absolutely correct. It is not part of the official process, but it is part of the practice of the recruiter to ensure that the migrant does not go to any other agent.
Then what happens once they actually arrive on Malaysian shores? Because I assume that's when, you know, the hole gets even deeper and it's even more difficult for them to get out of whatever situation they're about to find themselves in.
Yeah, so exactly like what Sumi has said, right? So many of these workers pay exorbitant amount of fees in order to be employed for employment in Malaysia. So when they arrive in Malaysia, they are already in the situation of debt bondage. And, you know, so, and what I mean by debt bondage is, so if I'm a Bangladeshi worker, for example, and I've paid 16,000 ringgit, which is a typical fee that a Bangladeshi worker would pay for employment in Malaysia. So I've paid 16,000 ringgit in Bangladesh, and I don't have this money, right? So I need to borrow from friends. I need to borrow this money from family. I need to borrow it from loan sharks, right? So I've got this debt in Bangladesh waiting for me. And I come to Malaysia and I work for employer A, for example, and I realize that the conditions of employment are not favorable to me. So, for example, employer A maybe shouts at me, makes me work long hours without paying me extra money for overtime. You know, and maybe employer A doesn't provide me with good living conditions. You know, many of us are crowded in one single container, for example, to live in. But am I allowed to leave? Am I able to leave? I can't, because I've got this debt of 16,000 ringgit hovering over my head in Bangladesh. So when I come, I'm forced to continue working in unfavorable working conditions to settle this debt that I currently have. I can't leave my employment because then, you know, what's going to happen to the loan sharks? What's going to happen to my family? I've had cases where families literally uproot the wives and the kids and put them in tents in order to mortgage and sell their homes to pay for employment fees. So in these situations, you know, workers arrive in Malaysia and they just have to accept whatever employment conditions or they have no choice but to accept employment conditions that they're faced with. The other thing I want to highlight is that we don't have a post-arrival orientation program which speaks to workers about their employment rights in Malaysia and the entities to which they can go to for assistance should an employment issue arise.
And is this orientation program something normal in other progressive countries?
Actually, it isn't. So what we typically see is orientation programs where workers, to a certain extent, are told about their rights. So some countries are better than Malaysia, I grant it, but they're informed about what their basic rights are. And you know, they're also told about what their job scopes will be when they're in Malaysia. But I've seen post-arrival orientation programs in Malaysia where companies actually have these programs. It's very geared towards educating workers about their job scope. So, for example, if you're a harvester, how do you harvest a palm fruit?
Right.
Or if you're a cleaner, like what is your job scope? How do you use chemicals? You know, how do you clean areas properly and thoroughly? So post-arrival orientation programs do not talk about rights and do not talk about where workers can go in order to kind of enforce some of these rights that they have. There are, of course, employers who try to recruit workers responsibly and, you know, they try to recruit workers using a zero recruitment fee policy. But I think the question here lies in how do these companies actually check whether or not workers are in fact not paying out of pocket? And, you know, if they find out that workers are in fact paying recruitment fees at the source countries, what is the company's next course of action? Do they pay these workers back the fees? Do they remediate the workers? Or do they just, you know, kind of turn a blind eye and you know, just say it's an isolated case and there's no need to check through the lot of the workers who arrive?
And I must add that we do see a lot of mismatch of work and expectation.
Right.
So, example, the worker would have been promised a job as a driver in a company. But when he comes here, he's made to work in the warehouse lifting heavy objects. So he may not be physically able to do the work. And that is exactly why he accepted a job as a driver. So his expectation is not met. And this is when some conflict will happen and the worker is not able to carry out the job. And then he leaves or the employer violates the worker's rights and makes the worker leave. Now, there's many situations like this.
On that note, we do need to go for a very quick break now. I'm speaking with Leva Sridharan, a labor rights consultant, and Sumita Shantini Krishna from the NGO Our Journey. We'll be back on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the show with me today are Leva Sridharan, a labor rights consultant, and Sumita Shantini Krishna from the NGO Our Journey. And we are talking about forced labor in Malaysia. Now, Sumita, let's talk about living conditions, which is something y'all alluded to earlier. Now, documented or undocumented, what can you tell us about the living conditions of migrant workers?
So housing has been a major problem. So we have a Ministry of Human Resources policy that dictates that employers must provide accommodation to the foreign worker when he comes into the country. But the amended Workers' Minimum Standards of Housing and Amnesties Act does not make it mandatory for the employer to provide accommodation. Many think that it is mandatory for the employer to provide, but it is not. The Act only applies where the employer provides the accommodation. So there was a hype. There was a lot of hype about the housing because of the COVID. In August 2020, we saw a regulation being gazetted on the maximum rental and charges for accommodation provided by employers. And it allowed employers to deduct up to 100 ringgit per month for rental. So for a migrant earning the minimum wage of 1,200, and with no legal permission to hold any other job to supplement his income, this deduction will hurt his capacity to provide himself for himself and his family. So the next best thing the worker would do is to find an accommodation on his own where he can save that 100 ringgit. That is by sharing one house with many, many other migrants.
Right.
You know, and this is exactly why they do that. It's not because they don't like the accommodation provided by the employer. They find it expensive. Secondly, a lot of the employers provided hostels have curfews, have restriction on movements. And a migrant is a migrant. They are also like Malaysians. They do not want to be sitting in the house after they do work. They want to have their freedom of movement as well, just like Malaysians. So again, that is also another reason why they don't want to stay in the employer's hostel. Many also tell us that they do not want to stay because it's so crowded and the facilities are so subhuman. I can give you an example where we went to a construction site. Mm-hmm. Although the law says that you cannot have hostel or anything built on a construction site and you will have to have your workers outside, we saw hundreds of workers staying in the floors that were completed. It's a posh condominium that is being built, but the workers are staying in the floors that have been completed.
Oh, no.
And we had an interview with the worker and said, well, why are you staying here? And they say, like, because we are working here. If you want to stay outside, it's too expensive and it's too far. Then we'll have to pay for transport. And also we'll have to pay for water, electricity. So if we stay in the building, the water electricity is paid by whoever the contractor is providing. So that's how we save money. That's what they will tell you. But we went in and saw there's no room per se. It's just cardboard boxes. Everybody has a communal toilet to use and also a communal kitchen. It's very, very... I can't imagine that we have that kind of accommodation provided for migrant workers in this type of era. For Malaysia, who is quite a progressive country, the type of accommodations that workers live in is really bad. And we also went to some of the hostels in Bukit Bintang. There were 30 people in that house. There was almost about like 10 people to a room, and the mattresses were just on the floor, side by side, no place to walk. They had to use strings attached to the windows to hang their clothes because they couldn't put in a cupboard. This is the type of accommodation that they live in. And this is the type of accommodation some employers do provide, but still want to deduct the rental from them. Is this right?
That's absolutely terrible. It's not right at all.
Yeah. So research has showed that with crowded accommodation, you will see an increase in sexual and gender-based violence. So that is definitely something that we see here. And COVID has also brought into light the consequences of having crowded accommodation. So you've got a situation where hundreds of workers in a particular housing area are infected with COVID-19, and then the infection then spreads to the wider community. So this is problematic, and this has come to light. We've also seen high cases of TB infections with migrant workers, again, because of overcrowded housing. So there are many, many consequences to this.
Can I add that COVID put a spotlight on accommodation of workers? Because other times, prior to COVID, usually the workers will use the accommodation on shift basis. So some workers go to their night work, and then these workers will use the accommodation. And then when they come back in the morning, then these workers go to work. But the COVID put everybody in the house at the same time. So we had received a lot of calls from workers saying that they couldn't bear the crowdedness in the accommodation that they've been living in for don't know how many years. It's because everybody was living at the same time. So if the Ministry of Human Resources did many inspections and they found that 90% of the employers did not comply with the act.
Right.
So this inspection should have been carried out more often. We need not have to wait for a pandemic for this to happen.
Exactly. But how does this happen? I mean, I'm listening to your stories, your insights, and it baffles my mind, right? Because how is it that this level of injustice is going on, but it seems like everyone who's involved somehow gets away with it, most of the time scot-free. In fact, whenever you do hear of arrests, it's always the migrant workers themselves who are poor, desperate, they are uneducated. These are the people who are facing punishment or deportation instead of the employers, you know, these big companies, the CEO of these multi-million dollar companies, billion dollar companies sometimes. What is going on here?
I think as a lawyer, it's a challenge when you go to the court and your client is arrested for not working without a legal permit, but the employer who provided the employment is not punished. There are many instances where the immigration will do a raid, pick up the worker from the workplace, but still not charge the employer. You know, and I feel the authorities are not prepared to dig deeper to find out the root cause of why these immigration laws are being violated, or why the migrants are unable to comply with the immigration laws.
Levi,
is this a problem here?
I think I would like to explore the concept of injustice a little bit more here.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a small town in Perak, and we never had high-rise buildings growing up. So construction sites were just usually for single-story or maximum double-story homes, you know. But when I came to KL, it was interesting for me to see these high-rise buildings being built by workers, so either migrant or Malaysian. And they're on the 12th, 13th floor, and they're working on those floors without harnesses, without safety boots, without safety helmets. So to me, this was very glaring and it was very shocking to see. But when I spoke to my friends who were born and raised in KL, to them, it was just something that didn't strike them at all as, you know, as interesting or wrong, because it was something that they were used to seeing. So it's interesting that you either innately or are socialized to close your eyes and kind of suspend your sight to something that you cannot see. And I think being aware of this is fundamental, because if we do not see these injustices, then people keep getting away with it scot-free. The policies, enforcement of policies are very weak. And, you know, we've got only 300 over labor inspectors in this country. And we've got thousands of companies that are actually, you know, we've got thousands of establishments or business establishments in Malaysia. And with only 300 some labor inspectors, you know, how do you enforce these labor laws in these different business settings?
Does corruption play a role in this vicious cycle that just never seems to end?
The whole labor migration recruitment system is nothing but a money-making venture. So let's just be honest. Corruption is a critical problem in the whole system.
All right. Now, Liva, how else did the pandemic change things? Do you see a big difference in the way as a country, or the institutes that are fundamentally in charge of taking care of these situations? Do you see a change in mindset, or do you see more enthusiasm, more eagerness to solve this problem post COVID-19?
So for me, the pandemic actually brought into focus how interconnected and interdependent we are as a human species, and how an injury to one is essentially an injury to all. So for example, you know, if you think of it in the form of the structure of a human body, right? Every organ has a purpose and a function. So if an organ is you know, not working in its optimal level, it affects the well-being of the body as a whole. So for me, the pandemic brought this up, because now we realize if we have double standards, so if migrants are allowed to live in overcrowded housing, for example, we find that, you know, it could be a breeding ground for you know, the spread of pandemics, or for the spread of other forms of diseases. And that would then also have a knock-on effect on everybody else within the area. So we're realizing now that double standards cannot work anymore. And if we start thinking of everybody, man, woman, migrant, Malaysian, as part of a system that is dependent on one another, then we will work to kind of ensure that every organ and every system is well protected. So then decisions and policy making will start becoming more inclusive and more just. You know, it will be able to reform structural inequalities that we've been seeing from the past, and things such as living conditions and working conditions will start being fair and decent for everybody.
Before I wrap up this conversation, I want to get both your takes on what can we possibly do to actually make real significant change to whatever is going on right now. Because as we've discussed, you know, throughout this conversation, this is not a very sort of clear-cut, easy, there's no easy solution to this, because it is so many layers are involved. It's you know, I think it's like Sumitra put it, you know, it's like this whole system, and this entire system is corrupt, and you don't know sometimes, you know, who exactly should be taking the blame for certain situations, because there are recruiters, there are sub-recruiters, there are sub-agents, there are so many people involved, people in Malaysia, people in all these countries where the migrants come from. So what should be the first sort of major change that we see? Sumita, let's start with you.
For one, we need to remove the labour migration portfolio from the Ministry of Home Affairs and give it to the Ministry of Human Resources, because this is a labour issue. It is not a security issue. There was a report, and I think you would find it if you Google, out of the 63 labour migration receiving countries in the world, 62 countries have the labour migration portfolio under their manpower or human resources. There's only one country in the world that does it under the Ministry of Home Affairs, and that is Malaysia.
Wow.
You know, so if the employer is still you know, and we need to hire migrants according to the market need. If the employer is still hiring undocumented workers over and above his quota, investigate why. You know, do not go and raid and arrest the migrant. Why is the worker being employed without a visa? Relook at the immigration control at the airports and other entry points. How is a person with no money, no hotel booking, still able to come into the country with a tourist visa? In our cases, it's just not the employer who violates the rights. It's a whole syndicate operating from the source country, at the borders, and in Malaysia itself. So this is why I feel that the Ministry of Home Affairs is not the right ministry to look at this portfolio at all. They do not have the mindset to look at it as a labor issue because they're so fixated with a security lens.
Leva?
Yeah, so I have two things to say actually in this regard. First of all, from the I'm in total agreement with Sumia, and from the source country sense, right? We realized, and you talked about this as well, that you know, there are many sub agents and sub agents involved in the whole recruitment process.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that the recruitment chain is deliberately long and complicated, and the longer the recruitment chain is, the more avenues there is for exploitation to happen.
Right.
So I think we need to look at how we can shorten this recruitment chain and make it accessible, make it easy to navigate for the migrant workers. And the other thing, because you asked about what we can do to change things up, right? So I think the other thing I want to mention is that the trick of remaining human as we progress through life is to get upset over injustices that we see. You know, we need to continue to feel upset because without that feeling of solidarity and human empathy, we kind of fail to care for human beings. And I believe that caring for human beings is actually our highest calling. So get upset when you see something that is unjust. Talk about it. You know, write to your MPs and relevant government agencies if you see something. If you see something that doesn't sit right with you, and we cannot underestimate the power of the voice of the people, right? And if we want policies to change, we need to be explicit about it. We need to be loud about it, and we also need to be curious and educate ourselves about what our fundamental rights are. And then question things that we see do not fit with our framework of what is fundamentally right and just, and call the people who are supposed to, you know, protect these rights and call them out and ask them why are these rights being trampled upon.
Well, on that very, very pertinent note, Leva, Sumita, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much.
That was Leva Sridharan, labor rights consultant, and Sumita Shantini Krishna from the NGO Our Journey. And we were talking about the truth about forced labor in Malaysia. So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or better yet, you can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. You just have to search BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.